For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So Jesus is teaching, and one of the Pharisees invited him home for a meal. This would have been kind of a large event. There was many Pharisees and scribes there, other religious leaders there probably as well. He was a pretty famous rabbi. So he went in, he took his place at the table. But his host was amazed to see that Jesus sat down to eat without first performing the hand washing ceremony required by Jewish custom. So Jesus blows right by the hand washing basin and grabs a seat. And the host is like, what was this hand washing ceremony? Well, Mark tells us that the Jews, especially the Pharisees, don't eat until they've poured water over their cupped hands as required by their ancient traditions. Not the reason why we wash our hands, which is for germs, which is a good idea. They washed their hands because they were afraid that in their daily interactions with people, like maybe they went to the marketplace, you know, there's like so many sinful people there in the marketplace, on the streets of the city, and you're bound to run into people. And if you, a pure person, like these Pharisees were, run into a sinful person, then what, you're going to get like sin cooties all over yourself. And then think how dangerous that would be then to go back and then to eat something. And, you know, the sin is just bypassing. It's going straight into your heart, right through your mouth. And so they had these ceremonial washing rituals that were just seen as, this is the thing all spiritual people do. It's required by their ancient traditions. We can read about this in the Mishnah, for example, the rabbinic teachings from that time. It says, you know, if a man poured water over the one hand with a single rinsing, his hand is clean. So you can do one hand with a rinsing, kind of cup your hand and hold it out. But if he did over both hands with a single rinsing, then Rabbi Meir declares them unclean, unless he pours over them a quarter log or more. Now, a log, you probably know, a log equals 6 eggshells. And so if you want to do one hand at a time, you're good. If you want to kind of do both hands and kind of have some, I guess somebody else would have to pour it over there for you, you better be using at least 1.5 eggshells worth of ceremonial cleansing water. Otherwise, you could be unclean. This could be really bad for you spiritually. The Babylonian Talmud, also from that time and a little later, reveals what a big deal the hand washings had become. It says, whoever eats bread without previously washing the hands is as though he had intercourse with a harlot. This is serious, people. Don't laugh. We got real spiritual dangers here. Dangers you never even knew about. Later on, it says, when he washed his hands, he should say, blessed is he who sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us concerning the washing of his hands. Now, what's the problem with this statement? God never commanded this. This is all later additions from the rabbis. The only washings prescribed in the Old Testament, there were a few washings that the priest had to do in conjunction with certain tabernacle rituals. Nowhere do we see that it's because they're washing sin off and that everybody has to wash the sin off their hands before they eat if they really want to be holy and clean before God. No, Jesus completely rejected this teaching. He says in Mark chapter 7, he says, look, food doesn't go into the mouth and into the heart. He says, no, it goes into the stomach and then out into the sewer, Jesus says. Which is ironic because excrement was actually not considered unclean to handle. So he's almost like, why is it only unclean when it goes in? He says, no. He says, it's not what goes into you. Your biggest problem is not, oh, you ran into a sinner and then you got some sin cooties in you. He says, no, what makes you unclean is all the wicked stuff that comes out of your heart. And he goes on a long list. And so Jesus declares all foods clean, which is one big difference between the Old and the New Covenant, among many others. Rejected the dietary laws. And he rejected this whole line of thinking. Even God had never prescribed this. God had some dietary laws in the Old Testament, but it was for a different teaching purpose. And so Jesus responds to this guy who's criticizing him, and he says, "You know, you Pharisees, you're so careful to clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're filthy. You're full of greed and wickedness. Thanks for inviting me to dinner." And so he gives this analogy. You clean the outside of the cup and the dish. I want you to imagine you go to a restaurant and the waiter sets a cup before you. And it's an empty coffee cup and he's about to pour the coffee in there. You're like, wait, hold on. Because you notice there's a little something in the cup. And upon closer inspection, you see that there's old coffee crusted around the side of the cup. Coffee and cream crusties. You see, there's actually, like, the outside of the cup is perfectly clean, but you also see there's like some green lipstick stick marks in there. You're like, who wears green lipstick? You also notice the previous patron of this cup had blown their nose in a napkin and had placed it in the cup. And it looks like they're a nose picker because you can kind of see some bloody boogers kind of coming out the side, kind of stuck to the cup. It looks like they were chewing green spearmint gum. That's in there too. And here the waiter was about to pour you a cup of coffee in that. Now, as a valued customer of this fine dining establishment, I would prefer that both the inside and the outside of the cup would be clean. However, if I had to pick, I would definitely pick the inside of the cup. And any employee who thinks I would prefer the outside to be clean over the inside does not understand what the customer wants. And imagine how God feels when we serve this sort of cup to Him. When we come to Him and we've only focused on the outside, the externals, we've cleaned up the outside, we're saying some of the right words, some of our behavior is conforming, but the inside is full of wickedness, is full of garbage, is full of the kind of things this cup was full of. I remember Jesus held out the law of God a couple weeks ago. We saw that the great commandment is to love God with all your heart, to love your neighbor as yourself. Those are pretty hard to do. I look into my heart and what I see in there, half of it I don't even understand. I see some pretty dark stuff swirling around in there, some pretty vile business. And what the hypocrite does is looks in and sees what's there and is so bothered by it that they just put the lid on their mug and they start polishing the outside of the mug. They start cleaning it up to make it nice and clean while the inside is full of the rottenest stuff imaginable. You know, it's one thing to be a sinner. Everybody's a sinner. That's the message of Christianity. But it's another thing to be a sinful, you know, God can handle that. God knows it. That's why he sent his son to die on the cross. But it's another thing to be a sinner and then to be all proud and to act like I've got it all together and to try to suppress and try to hide from God, much less from other people, and to polish the outside and then to come to God like I've got my stuff together. Nothing makes God angrier than hypocrisy. You can see by the way Jesus talks about this. You see how he treats the prostitutes and the tax collectors. He's actually pretty kind to them. He says, go and sin no more. He goes to parties with them. He goes to this party, he starts rebuking the religious leaders because they're hypocrites. You can see when Jesus starts name calling, when the Apostle Paul starts talking about hypocrites, you see really vulgar language coming from him. You know, it's pretty bad when the Apostle Paul starts to not keep a careful eye on his tongue. Nothing makes God angrier than hypocrisy. So what is hypocrisy? I'll tell you what it's not. It's not when a Christian sins. Some people are like, oh, I saw that Christian sin the other day. That must mean they're such a hypocrite. That's not hypocrisy. Christians never claim to be sinless. And anyone who is a hypocrite. No, we admit that we're sinful, and we know that God has cleansed us because of Jesus Christ. That's the message of hope we hold out. It's not sinning. It's acting like I never sinned. That would be hypocritical. It would be getting really angry about this one thing, and then secretly I'm doing that one thing. Jesus says, you know, hypocrisy, it's kind of like being an actor. In fact, the word he uses for it, if we look in our lexicon, the word for hypocrite, the verb is to create a public impression that is at odds with one's real purposes or motivations. It's where the outside doesn't match the inside, and I'm intentionally making the outside look one way because I'm trying to hide what's on the inside. The noun means literally actor in all of our Greek literature, but in the New Testament, it's only used in the metaphorical sense, a pretender, a hypocrite, hypocrites. We look in another lexicon, gives us examples from ancient literature of how this word is used. Diogenes says, you know, the art of the hypocrite, the actor, is from the moment he dons the mask, his whole conduct on stage should be in keeping with his allotted role. You know, the actor, they put the mask on, they put the makeup on, they go up, they play the part, then they come off stage and they're back to who they really are. Jesus says, that's what you guys are like. And if you've ever had to be in a play where you had to wear makeup or a costume or a performance where you had to wear some kind of special getup, I know for me, the first thing I want to do as soon as that's over is to get out of that costume and to get back into some normal clothes. So I feel weird wearing this thing that just isn't me. Aristotle, here's how he talks about the hypocrite. He says the actor's job is to present the drama assigned to him by artistic reciting accompanied by mime and gesture. So the whole body is getting into it. It's not just the voice, but it's the body. And you know, he talks about mime here. And I don't know about you guys, but there's something about mimes that just creep me out. You know, they got their makeup on. They're all white-faced, and they're like, ooh, look at me. I'm in a box. Ooh, ooh, ooh. It's like, no, there's no box. Like, oh, but look at me. I'm pulling this rope here, and look at me. I got a rope. It's like, no, there's no rope. I guess a really good mind might be able to make you think there's a box there or a rope, but there's not. That's the whole point. The better the hypocrite, the better they're able to pretend that something's real. That's not real. And when we go to God and we're like, ooh, ooh, look at me. I'm spiritual. I've got it all together. God's like, no, 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 you don't. You might, if you could admit you're a hypocrite, if you could admit your sin, you might have a shot. Then I could get in there. I could help you clean out that nasty stuff that's on the inside of your cup. But until then, I can't help you. And you and honestly, you're misrepresenting me. I'm pretty upset with you, God says. Jesus says, it's also like yeast. It's like yeast, he says a little bit later in this passage. Be on your guard against the yeast or the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Now today we get yeast in these little packets. It's like powdered stuff. Back then they didn't have that. What they had was something that would have looked kind of like this. This is a sourdough lump. This is kind of a starter lump. It's dough that's been permeated by these microscopic organisms. Give it kind of a sour taste. See all the bubbles that it produces on there. In order to make your bread, you take your flour and water, you mix it together, and then you take a little pinch of this. It can be as little as 2% of the whole lump of dough you're trying to make. And you put a little bit of this in there, and you kind of work it together, and then you set that lump in a warm place. And within a short amount of time, the organisms in there will have permeated, reproduced, made their way through the entire lump, and the entire lump will begin to rise. Not because it's actually rising, but because there's little air bubbles that it releases. This is why our bread has little pockets of air inside of it. And you know, there's a lot of good analogies, actually, between yeast and hypocrisy. For one, it's contagious. You put a couple influential hypocrites into a group of Christians. Before you know it, everybody's got their mask on, everybody's on guard, everybody's watching their back, everybody's afraid of being judged. I've been in groups like this. Came to Christ in a group like this. It's also has a puffing up quality You know, it makes that dough rise, not because it's actually producing any more dough. No, it's filling it with empty air. And it's making it look bigger and puffier. And that's part of the goal of hypocrisy, is to make myself look better than I really am. But it's all air. It's all fake. It's all a show. It's also silent. It doesn't make a lot of noise. It doesn't make any noise. It permeates in a silent but deadly way through the entire lump. And hypocrisy works that way as well. It can take over a group before you know it. And that's why Jesus says you better be on guard. Because it can be pretty hard to turn the tide once the yeast has permeated through the entire lump. And now the hypocrites, not only have they invited Jesus to dinner, but now they're judging him. They're upset with him that he's not following their little external washing rule that they made up. And they're just so astonished that this great rabbi is not playing by their rules that they made up to make themselves seem more holy. And now the dinner party is about to get pretty awkward. They're not going to get what they expected from Jesus, as usual. He's full of surprises. In fact, he's going to tell them what he really hates most about their hypocrisy. And it's two things, two points he really makes. One is because of how it shifts our focus to the external. And two, because of how hypocrisy ruins people's lives. He's going to give them six woes, three for each of these. Woe to you. Let's read. It shifts our focus to the external. He says, "You fools! Didn't God make the outside of the cup as well as the inside? So clean the inside by giving gifts to the poor, and you'll be clean all over." Jesus said, you need to focus on the inside. The outside tends to take care of itself if you get the inside straightened out. Not so much with cups, but with people. That's how it works. I think it's interesting, too, he points out giving. Failure to give sacrificially of our money, that could be a sign of hypocrisy. You got the person who shows up and they just share these spiritual things and they get all this attention and then look at their wallet, look at their checkbook. That would be a sign of real authenticity, of real sacrificial giving. Giving in a way, you know, when hypocrites do give, they tend to blow the trumpets and make sure everybody knows that they're giving like the Pharisees do. But to give quietly, sacrificially, humbly, that's the sort of thing that a true, authentic spiritual person would do. He says, "Woe to you! What sorrow awaits you!" That's, I think, a better translation than "woe to you." What sorrow awaits you? You can see the sadness along with the anger from Jesus. You Pharisees, you're careful to tithe even the tiniest income from your herb gardens, but you ignore justice and the love of God. You should tithe, yes, but don't neglect the more important things. These Pharisees, they'd be in here. And they'd be like, "Oh, I planted some herbs this year. Some vegetables and some herbs." And, you know, they're in there and they're counting the leaves on their basil plant. And they're like, "God provided me with 73 leaves this year. But he requires a tenth of everything and I'm so holy. But my question is, do I give him 7.3 leaves? Do I round up to 8 leaves? What would the Lord have me do here? To meticulously follow the law." And Jesus is like, "Guys, what's easier? Justice and loving God, or giving a tenth of your oregano harvest?" It's like, you're really that holy that this is what you're worried about? This is what you're telling people about? You know, meanwhile, he says later, "You shamelessly cheat widows out of their property." You're like, "Oh, I got to tithe my oregano." And then they turn around and they're like, "All right, Grandma, where's my money? Get out. This is my house now. Hope you can find a way to make ends meet now that you're living on the street." And so such a contradiction between what they said. I mean, I guess technically they're probably following their laws that they'd made up that allowed them to throw this grandma out on the street and take her property. But that's not justice. That's not love. That's selfishness and greed and materialism and pride. Jesus says, "You blind guides, you strain out a gnat, but you swallow a camel." A little humor there from Jesus. You know, the gnat and the camel were both considered unclean animals. So like, like in the Old Testament, God actually had certain animals that were considered unclean. So you weren't allowed to make like either a camel sandwich or a gnat sandwich. But Jesus is like, okay, but if you were going to accidentally consume an unclean creature, wouldn't it make more sense to eat the gnat? I mean, imagine here you're about to take a drink of water and you're like, whoa, hold on there. Got a little gnat in there. Get out of there, little buddy. Thank God. I was almost defiled. And then they're like, and they swallow a camel. You guys are so concerned with gnats, you're drinking camels right and left. I think it's actually kind of helpful because you think about the things Christians are usually upset about. They often fall into the gnat department. Things that are not even sins, or they're like, they're such small sins that why are we even talking about this? You think about drinking. It's like the worst thing you can do in the minds of some Christians. And Jesus drank. He made wine. Not even a sin to drink in this country if you're over 21. That varies from country to country even. Tobacco products. It's like some Christians are so angry about tobacco products. Look, you can definitely not smoke and hate God, okay? I mean, you shouldn't. You shouldn't smoke. It's not good for you. But I mean, the deal that some Christians make out of this, it's so out of proportion. Non-Christian music in books and movies. It's like a sin to listen to non-Christian music and to read books, and Christians create their own subculture. And it's like they're saying it's a sin to associate with culture. Jesus says you should be in the world, but not of the world. We want to be similar in ways where we can that are non-moral, like these. Dancing. Some Christians are like, dancing is sinful. Okay, you know, I mean, some of us probably shouldn't dance, right? Because it's embarrassing. Like me, that's why I don't dance. It's not because it's sinful. Foul language. It's pretty hard to find a verse in the Bible on this. I guess there's one or two here and there. It would be considered a sin, but I mean, for some Christians, this is the mark of true Christianity. This is the thing that you just don't do. And part of what, I think because it's kind of easy to control when you're around your Christian friends. Sorry. When you're around your Christian friends. And part of what it always made me want to do is just not hang around other Christians. Because it was hard enough to control my language, and I could only do it for a limited amount of time. What you wear, some Christians, certain things are just off limits. And, you know, ladies, you're not allowed to wear pants because that's of the devil. And you should just have a whole closet full of jean jumpers with your head coverings. Tattoos and piercings. Voting for a Democrat. Speeding. Yes, the Lord was really convicting me on my speeding lately. I was doing 68 and a 65. And I'll never do it again, God. Focused on rituals. That's like what these guys were doing that Jesus is interacting with. They've got certain rituals, and you got to do those, and you can do pretty much whatever else you want as long as you do the rituals. It's hypocrisy. God's not happy with that at all. On the other hand, you think about camels, sexual sin, that would be a camel. Talk about something that's emphasized in Scripture. The damage it does to you, to the other person, to the body of Christ. What about coldness toward God and other people? It's like, I don't drink, but I also hate God. I never spend time with Him. When people are around me, they just feel like I'm just the coldest, most unloving person. Really a jerk. They definitely don't want to get on my bad side. What about loving money and showing contempt for the poor? How many Christians do you see getting really worked up about materialism? a sin that Jesus denounces strongly and warns against, and the rest of the New Testament does as well. Strong warnings against the love of money and how it destroys our spiritual lives. Not a lot of hypocrites are too concerned about that. What about pride and hypocrisy? How much of our anger towards some of these gnats is matched by any anger toward hypocrisy and the damage it does to the witness of Christians in this world? How much of our anger toward sin matches Jesus' anger toward hypocrisy? And so I think that's a helpful way to think about it, is this thing, would this be more of a gnat or a camel? Some of us think in really black and white terms and have a hard time with this. What we need to realize is some sins, you know, one sin is enough to make us guilty before God, but not all sins are equal in the damage that they do and their severity. And we need to have a more nuanced look, and we need to, because we're like, well, let's just emphasize all sin. Well, if you do that, what you do is your focus shifts to the easy ones. What you need to emphasize victory over the more devastating sins. Application, there's a discernment point here. You know, if I'm getting really angry about this sin in somebody else's life, maybe I need to take a second look and think about, is it possible I'm trying to shift the focus off of some camels in my life? Some sin that I'm feeling pretty bad about? I can often trace that back for myself and for other people. I can't tell you how many times I've interacted with a Christian who's so angry about something minor, and it turns out they were hiding something major. I'll give you a couple examples. I heard a story a little while back about this guy. He was a newer believer, comes from a pretty rough past, and he was talking to one of the leaders in his group, and he was like, man, did you hear about so-and-so and what he did with his girlfriend? You know, I heard he felt her up. I'm really, really upset about that, really worried about that. And I was like, oh, yeah, he confessed that right away. Sounds like he's doing a lot better. He's really come out in the light on that. He's like, oh, I'm just really concerned about that. And Leader's like, so how are you doing with your non-Christian girlfriend? He's like, oh, we're doing fine. He's like, really? So I thought I heard that you guys got into some stuff that was way worse than this other thing that you're upset about with this brother over here. And the guy was like, yeah, you're right. Here he was really mad about something less than what he was into. Heard stories about people, somebody who's in sexual sin, is lying, is being hypocritical about it, being divisive. And you know what they're really angry about? About the gossip in this group. Can you believe that people heard about this? Like, maybe you should be a little more upset about the sin in your own life instead of pointing the finger at everybody else who's actually trying to help you. I remember being in, I came to Christ in a pretty legalistic, hypocritical environment. And I spent, basically my senior year in high school, before I came up to college at Ohio State, I spent it in a pretty legalistic small group. And I remember several episodes where, I would show up at this meeting and I just felt like, I am so inferior to the people here. I've got sin in my life. I could never tell these people about it. These people, they've got it all together. Remember this one guy, he and his girlfriend coming forward to confess that he had cheated on this test and he got caught and he was weeping and she was weeping and there was just this air of repentance and confession. And, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, okay, that's not good. But if you're this upset about that, there's just no way I could ever open up about the sin in my life. Turns out, I find out a couple years later, they'd been sleeping together the entire time they'd been dating for the past 6 months. And it wasn't just them, it was a co-ed small group. Every single other person in that cell group was having sex with someone else in that cell group, except for me. I remember another group I was in when I came to college here. I ended up in this other group for a little while, and we were sitting around in this guy's group. There's seven or eight of us, and we're talking about something. I was like, oh, man, that guy is a real jerk. Except I didn't say jerk, okay? It was a synonym for jerk. I didn't even know it was a bad word. It turns out it's a euphemism for the male sex organ. But I didn't even know it was a bad word, okay? I just thought it meant an unpleasant person. But as soon as I said it, the whole conversation went, and everybody turned and looked at me. And like, what'd you say? And I was like, I said, that guy is a real jerk. Except I said the other word again. And I was like, is that bad? And they're like, well, don't you know what that means? And that's a bad word. And we looked it up, and I was like, okay. I guess it is. But again, I just thought, there's no way I'm going to open up about the real sin in my life now if I got that kind of a reaction. You're saying a word I didn't even know was a cuss word. Again and again, we see this is a killer of community, and it's a ruse to get the attention off of the real stuff. He says, what sorrow awaits you, Pharisees, for you love to sit in the seats of honor in the synagogues. You love to receive the respectful greetings as you walk in the marketplaces. You know, Jesus expounds in Matthew 23, which is his other big beatdown on hypocrisy. He says, everything you do is done for people to see. The Pharisees, they make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. All right, what's he talking about with phylacteries and tassels? Well, in the Old Testament, God said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he says, and this command, I want you to talk about it when you wake up in the morning. Talk about it when you go to bed at night. I want you to bind it to your doorposts. I want you to bind it to your forehead and to your arms. Obviously, in the metaphorical sense, they took them literally, though. And what they did is they would write scripture, and not the part about loving God with all your heart. They'd write the part that says, bind this to your head. And they'd put it in a box, and they would literally strap it to their head. It looked like this. You can see the box on his head. They also had these forearm straps, and they would attach it right to the inside of the elbow. Same box, same verse. It says, tie this to your elbow. And then these tassels, they have these tassels, and tassels would be kind of hanging down from the thing they wore over their shoulders. And in kind of this like one-upmanship to see who's more spiritual, some of these guys, they would like, the boxes started getting bigger and bigger that they would wear on their foreheads. They would broaden their phylacteries, Jesus says, and they would lengthen their tassels to really show off their spirituality. So you can imagine these two Pharisees coming up to each other, and the guy's like, oh man, you call that a phylactery? Dude, look at the size of my phylactery. My phylactery is way bigger than your phylactery. It's like, and your tassels, look how little they are. My tassel's so big. It's so long. When I go for a walk, it looks like I'm taking my pet anaconda for a walk. When I go around a corner, you can tell I've been there for several minutes. Because you can still see my tassel dragging behind. They started having to put restrictions on the size of these things. Jesus is like, you guys are ridiculous. How spiritual you are has nothing to do with the size of your phylactery. Or the length of your tassel. Has to do with the heart and what's in your heart. Yes, what sorrow awaits you, for you're like hidden graves in a field. People walk over them without knowing the corruption they're stepping on. Yeah, it would defile you if you walked over a tomb, over a grave. And so what they would do sometimes is they would make sure to mark the graves when the pilgrims would come in for the festivals. But Jesus says, you guys, you're like graves, and nobody knows it's there. It says on the inside, they're full of dead men's bones. They're full of corruption. You can clean up the outside of the coffin, the outside of the tomb, the outside of the grave, and it might look nice, but what's on the inside? That's the real problem. You know, and so he's like, what's inside you? Here's a wax sculpture of a rotting corpse. Pretty gross. Jesus says, you might have a nice looking coffin, but this is really what the inside looks like. This is how God sees you. You know, you can hit the outside with all the whitewash you want. You can wear Christian clothes and listen to Christian music. But it's going to take more than that to clean that rottenness on the inside. You know, it's really the silent killer, the silent defiler. It's like carbon monoxide gas where the room could be full of it and you can't even sense it until it's too late. That's what hypocrisy does to our spiritual lives. That's what it does to the spirituality in a group. And then one of the scribes who's sitting there, he's like, hey, Jesus, I don't know if you realize this, but you've insulted us too in what you've said. And Jesus is like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to insult you guys. Yeah, what sorrow awaits you, experts in religious law? I almost forgot to mention you. Woe to you, because you crush people with unbearable religious demands and you never lift a finger to ease the burden. Yeah, here's the three woes that talk about how hypocrisy ruins people's lives. Their teaching was doing more harm than good. Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary, and I'll give you rest, because my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I want to share the yoke. That's the point of a yoke. There's two oxen in the yoke. Jesus says, come on. Come over here. I'll be on this side. You be on that side. Let's do this. He says, you'll find rest for your souls. Not so. These guys, their teaching was just crushing people. In a part, you know, they make following God seem so hard. This is what hypocrites do. They make it seem so unattractive. They tell people to try harder versus really getting in there and trying to help them. People need more than just commands to do better. They need somebody to understand, why are they falling into sin? What is it they're failing to believe? They need someone to empathize with them, counsel them, teach them, help them. They need someone to share their struggles too. How did I have victory in this area? People need real help. One of the greatest helps we can do is we can build a community that's a safe place where we can get the support that we need. This is the greatest, one of the greatest things you can do in overcoming sin is getting part of a group of Christians who are following God. The problem is hypocrisy isolates people. It doesn't build a safe place. It builds a place where I have to watch my back. And that's exactly what they're building. And it's crushing people. People are losing heart. They're quitting altogether. What sorrow awaits you, for you build monuments for the prophets your own ancestors killed long ago. If you read the Old Testament, one of the themes is the prophets are not popular and many get killed, tortured, imprisoned. And they're like, oh, if only we had been there. Isaiah, poor Isaiah, if we'd been there, we would have believed in you, even if no one else had. Because we're so holy. Let's build another monument for Isaiah. Oh, Jeremiah, we would have taken your side. Oh, Habakkuk, how do we love thee? Let me count the ways. Jesus is like, you guys, you make this show about how what you would have done if you'd been there, but what are you doing to the prophets today? What are you doing to the Son of God? He says, in fact, you stand as witnesses who agree with what your ancestors did by your very actions. Your condemnation of their actions, you condemn yourself. They killed the prophets and you join in their crime by building the monuments. This is what God in his wisdom said about you. I'm going to send prophets and apostles to them. And they're going to kill some and persecute the others. And as a result, this generation will be held responsible for the murder of all of God's prophets, from the creation of the world, from the murder of Abel on the first pages of the Jewish Bible, to the murder of Zechariah on the last pages of the Jewish Bible, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, it will certainly be charged to this generation. He says, you know, the court hearing for those guys, you're going to be present too. And we're going to put you all on trial together. How do you like that? Because what you've done is even worse than what they did. They killed prophets. You're going to kill the Son of God. And finally, what sorrow awaits you, experts in religious law? You remove the key to knowledge from the people, and you don't enter the kingdom yourselves, and you prevent others from entering. Hypocrites do not want people reading their Bibles. One big reason for that is because they have so many man-made rules and loopholes. You know, they've thousands of laws that they've multiplied on top of what God has said, leaving out the grace part, and then they build loopholes that only they know about so they can truly pat themselves on the back and say we're completely following the law of God. It'd be a full-time job just to keep up with them. They don't want people getting in there and reading about what God really says, because it's a very different picture than what they're presenting. Ordinary people that are genuinely seeking, they're either turned away because it just seems so hard and confusing, or if they're really zealous, they might become a convert, a disciple of a Pharisee, and become hypocrites too. Like Jesus said, you travel over land and sea to make a single convert, and then when you get one, you make him twice the son of hell that you are. You brood of vipers, you snakes, you hypocrites, you blind guides, you fools. Look, grace has to be taught and modeled for people to really get it. This is the key, the grace of God. So how did they respond? Well, you know how they should have responded? They should have been like, you're completely right. I can't believe it got this far. I'm acting here. I'm pretending. I'm puffing myself up. What can I do about the rottenness that's truly in my heart? My lack of love for God, my lack of love for people. What can I do to make things right? And instead, how they responded was this. As he was leaving, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees became hostile. And they tried to provoke him with many questions. They're trying to trap him, it says. They wanted to trap him into saying something they could use against him. We'll show him. And they began looking even more intently for a way to kill him. That's how they responded. How did I respond? Like I told you, I came out of an environment like this. I feel like I was starting to go down this path early in my spiritual life. I'd grown up in a legalistic church setting, never was into it. We would skip out. We would go out to eat during the service. We would hide out and play cards or whatever. Beginning my senior year, I actually met Christ in a personal way. Started trying to follow God, but had a whole year of trying to look better than I really was, focusing on the minor things, trying to watch my step. And then I remember when I came out to a Bible study here, my freshman year in college, I remember just being amazed that the teaching would come to an end and then people just wanted to sit around and hanging out with each other for a long time. And I was like, I'm used to running for the car as soon as the service ends. It was really, I had a really hard time with it. I also felt like I had sin in my life that I felt like I'm the only one that struggles with this. I'm trying hard to get it together. I would sit before God and I would weep and I would vow to do better, but then I would find myself right back there again. I felt like my love for God was growing cold. I wasn't as zealous or devout as I should be. And then I remember, I also had a roommate at the time. He's not a Christian. He was an alcoholic. He was a drug dealer. I would judge him a lot too. And I remember I was riding back from a Bible study with the guy that used to pick me up and take me there and bring me home. And I was like, man, I'm just so glad I don't drink like a lot of these people on campus. And he was like, you know, some of my roommates actually drink. You know, they're 21. They're really godly dudes. And I knew the guys he was talking about. I'm like, I respect those guys a ton. You know, the guy was really gracious about it, and we moved on. But in my heart, God was like, you have the wrong standard for right and wrong. I felt rebuked by God there. Not enough to crack my shell. But it was something, okay? I remember another time where we were again driving home from home church, and I had increasingly been asking to leave as soon as, you know, sooner and sooner after teaching, and I would make up an excuse like I have to study, which I wasn't going to go do. And I remember the guy was taking me home one time, and he was like, "Hey, I think it's cool that you really like the teachings, but I think you might be missing out on some of the fellowship, the friendships that you can build there. I view that as a really important part of going to home church." And again, he was really gentle, really nice about it. But part of what it was getting at was my fear of letting people in. It was also getting at my extreme social anxiety. I just didn't know how to talk to people in groups. And so I basically just opened up. I was like, "You're totally right." I almost started tearing up because this was such like an issue I was sensitive about. And I couldn't believe this guy was saying this to me. Part of me felt so loved by it, though. And I shared about my anxieties being around people in groups. I shared about just, I don't know what to say. It was a really good conversation. I felt like a wall came down there with him. Then, this was maybe another month or two after that, getting around about the end of the school year, right about this time. And I'd started going to this men's Bible study on Friday nights. And I remember we were sitting around one time, and one of the leaders there, he opened up about this sin in his life. And I was like all tensed up. I couldn't believe that he was sharing this with a group of people. Like, it was astonishing to me. I didn't know what to do with it. But as he was sharing, as he got down, I thought to myself, he can share that. Maybe I can share the thing that I've been hiding the whole time I've been a Christian. And so on the way home that night, I really awkwardly, really nervously got the courage up to confess. And I thought I was going to get this, like I got when I said that word I didn't even know was a swear word. And he was like, "Oh, yeah." And I was like, you know, I've struggled with that too. I know a lot of people that do. And I felt so free. And all I had to do was open up and be real and stop putting on a front and looking down my nose at people to compensate for the shame that I felt. You know, all of the crying before God and vowing to do better, I gained more power in that one single confession than I feel like I did with all the promises that I made and all the tears that I shed. And I moved into a ministry house a month later, and I was determined. I've lived hiding for so long, I'm going to be the most open guy in this house. And I think it kind of startled the guys that were living there. They'd gotten kind of comfortable. But, you know, then it was funny because, you know, it's only a few months later, and then guys are coming to me saying, "Boy, you've really upped the level of vulnerability in this house here. Significant change in a pretty short amount of time, if you'll agree with God on this." Freedom. Jesus said, "I come to set people free." So how will you respond? Jesus gives a couple suggestions. In Luke 12, he says, "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees, their hypocrisy." We are not immune to this, okay? We're pretty good on this, especially as far as Christians go. We're not immune. I want you to ask yourself a few questions to see if we could possibly struggle with hypocrisy as well. Have you ever held back the full extent of your sin in order to seem more spiritual than you really are? You ever shared like a half sharing? Why would you do that? Those are the seeds of hypocrisy. Have you ever felt bad that someone else got more recognition than you? Why would you care unless what people think are more important than what God thinks? It's only a small step to putting yourself forward and showing off your righteousness. Do you act differently around your Christian friends? Why would you need to do that? Why can't you just be you? Instead of the good me and then the other me, the real me, and compartmentalize your life. You ever been defensive when confronted with personal failure? Why would you need to get angry and defend yourself? because you're worried about how you're coming off to people. It's there in our hearts, guys. It's there. It wouldn't be that hard for us to go from an authentic group to a group where people are hiding and where we're fake. Jesus also says, you know, the time is coming when everything that's covered up will be revealed. And everything that's secret will be made known to all. And whatever you've said in the dark will be heard in the light. And whatever you've whispered behind closed doors will be shouted from the housetops for all to hear. So the point is not even, well, God already knows, which he does. The point is, pretty soon, everybody's going to know. There's going to be no more secrets. I don't know what that day's going to be like. You know, some of it's in this life. I found people that are trying to hide sin usually can't do it for that long. You might as well just come out with it now. But even if you could somehow manage to hide, when we get to that day when every secret is revealed, you know, you got anything in your life that's covered up or secret, anything said in the dark or whispered behind closed doors, it's not going to stay there for long. In fact, there's a lot of good reasons for coming out into the light. Tonight, to come out into the light. Like this one right here that God already knows and everybody else will soon. But there's others. What about the fact that if you would just confess, you no longer have to carry around the burden of lying and pretending. Making sure your story's straight. Trying to make sure that, wondering what's going to happen, will people find out? Always on edge. You can lay that burden down and just be real. You can stop injecting hypocrisy and lies into every gathering of the body of Christ. How about that? That would be kind of nice. You realize as you go through this charade and you hide and lie, you're injecting lies into every interaction of the body of Christ, into every friendship. In fact, your friends probably know something's wrong. And they might even be blaming themselves. And I remember I hung out with this guy every week for about 6 months. The whole time he was in sexual sin, the whole time he was lying to me. I kind of suspected there was something, but he wouldn't admit to it. And at a certain point, I just started thinking, well, maybe I'm just not trying hard enough in this friendship. Maybe I need to open up more. Maybe I need to pray more. Maybe I'm holding back something in my heart. And it turns out, no, he was lying the whole time, wasting my time, going through some stupid charade of meeting together. I don't know what he got out of it. I didn't get anything out of it. I could have been doing something good with that time every week. Thought he was being sincere. It's pretty annoying. It's pretty infuriating, actually. Let's just come clean and stop spreading the hypocrisy, spreading the yeast. Another benefit is you can stop hardening your heart and finally reconnect with God and other people. Wouldn't that be nice? Maybe God sent me here tonight to give you this very message. That's the why you've had the coldness in your heart toward God and people. That's why you're exhausted. Let's come clean. Now, don't wait any longer. And finally, you can get the help that you need. It's not just the negative case, but there's a positive case here. You can get freedom and victory by coming out into the light. All right, let's just draw a couple conclusions. Look, please, please, join with me in fighting this. And the others in this room that are committed to that as well. I know that many of us hate this. I've lived this, though. And I don't know what I would say to God when I stand before him someday if on my watch this church turned into a fake, hypocritical place where people are lying and pretending and putting on the mask and they can't wait to get off stage so they can go back to the real them, where we lose all of our spiritual power. It's not by becoming the legalism police. Some people are like, legalism. I play that, push that button a little too often, maybe. It's not by embracing sin. Sin is awful. Sin ruins people's lives. It's not forsaking imperatives either. I remember one guy was like, you know, ever since I really understood grace, I've completely eliminated all commands from my teachings. I'm like, well, the Bible is full of them. So what are you teaching? No, it's by putting the focus where it should be. Not stand by staying firm against real problems, not the fake superficial ones that we come up with, the real ones that God says to emphasize, by being authentic and leading the way in vulnerability, not expecting somebody else to share first. You should be the person that makes other people feel like, I guess I can share my thing now. This person shared that. It's by never, ever settling for going through the motions. It's where I take responsibility to get my heart in the right place. And the only cure is grace. The only cure for hypocrisy is grace. Grace is our secure starting point for authenticity. Grace lets me be free to share my real struggles. Grace means it doesn't matter what other people think about me or who gets the credit for this. Grace means that my value and standing is unaffected by my performance. And under grace, we stand together in awe of God as He changes lives from the inside out. Yeah, Father, really freeing to not have to labor under the guise of pretending to be someone, pretending before other people, but ultimately, God, we're pretending before You. Thank You that You sent Your Son to wipe out all of our shame and all of our guilt, and that all we've got to come to You is with the empty hands of grace and allow You to forgive us, God, and take our sins onto Him. Thank You, too, for how that sets us free in our relationships, God. Not freedom to sin, but freedom to love, freedom to be real, freedom to admit that when we failed. God, I suspect there are people here tonight who have been laboring in the darkness for a long time. And I pray they wouldn't spend one more day there, but that they would come out into the light and they would get that freedom that You promise. And I pray, God, that this church would always be a place where people can come and awkwardly, scared, come out and find freedom, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.